property that are being committed by the apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer. But they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bourizza, London.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome. Known for having oversaw an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation, Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for an investigation into blowing terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Ku San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hello, Commander. It's the title of a new epic song themed with support for the Islamic Revolution and its leader, from the mouth of Iranian children. The pop choir has recently been chanted in every corner in Iran, from TV shows to schools and public places. On Thursday, some 100,000 people jam-packed Tehran's Azadi Stadium to sing along Salam Farmande, Persian for Hello Commander.
Although we have not seen the Islamic revolution, but we, as the new generation, will hold on to the ideals of the revolution and our leader. This is the theme of this song.
Hello, Commander, is about Imam Mahdi. In the song, we urge Imam Mahdi hasty arrival to save humankind from cruelty.
The song addresses Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam, and the prophesied apocalyptic savior in Shia Islam, who is believed to be currently living in occultation.
I brought my children to this gathering because they love Imam Mahdi. Here, they learn to be the soldiers of Imam Mahdi.
I came to show my love for Imam Mahdi. In the song, we assure our leader that we will be loyal to Imam Mahdi.
In a part of the song, children promise Imam Mahdi that they will tread on the path of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force commander, who was assassinated by the United States in Iraq in 2020.
In this song, we as the new generation vow to be the next Qasem Soleimani. We are proud of him because he brought us security. I wish he was here today.
The song was first broadcast from Iran's national television on March 20th this year, after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a televised Persian New Year speech. Since then, the song has been performed in schools and national public occasions as a show of support for the Islamic Republic.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism." And some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member. It sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking, and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting, and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses, and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found stingers and javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
In the limelight. The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week. With the gun massacre in East Buffalo, followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and printed in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, U.S. Leaders Are Failing in Their Most Basic Duty. The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week, with the gun massacre in East Buffalo followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? There is incredulity at the inaction of the police in Uvalde, Texas. 78 minutes elapsed after the gunman walked inside before police, believing there were no kids at risk, finally confronted him, according to Stephen McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Meanwhile, 911 dispatchers received several calls from inside the classroom, including repeated calls from a child begging them to send in the police. By the end of his rampage, the gunman had killed 19 children and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. Stephen McGraw acknowledged the multiple failures of judgment. In response to a question about whether the commander at the scene should offer an apology to the victims' families, he said, "If I thought it would help, I would apologize." Police held back a group of horrified parents who gathered even as shots continued to ring out inside the school, and begged police officers to move in and try to rescue their children. At least one mother was put in handcuffs only to spring over a fence and sprint into the school to scoop up her child when the opportunity presented itself. The police, she said, were doing nothing. Those officers had been training for years for just such an attack, yet when the moment came, all that preparation did nothing to stop a gunman wielding an assault rifle in a school full of children. There is unspeakable grief over the deaths of children like Layla Salazar, who'd like to make TikTok videos, wear denim jackets and sing Sweet Child O' Mine on the way to school each morning. "They took her away from us," Layla's grandfather, Vincent Salazar, told the New York Times. How do you mend a broken heart from a family as close as we had? Irma Garcia, a teacher at the Robb Elementary School, liked classic rock. Her body was found with children still in her embrace, according to her nephew. A fourth grader who survived the attack said that Miss Garcia and another teacher, Eva Mireles, had saved his and other students' lives. "They were in front of my classmates to help," he said, "to save them." There is also a profound sense of national exhaustion that comes when tragedy is layered upon tragedy. In Buffalo, three funerals were held on Friday for victims of the mass shooting that took place at a supermarket on 14th of May. 10 people were killed in that attack and 3 others were wounded. "It's like Groundhog's Day. We've seen this over and over again," Mark Talley, the son of one of the victims, Geraldine Talley, said at a news conference on Thursday, 26th of May. In Buffalo, a white gunman targeted a predominantly black neighborhood with his AR-15-style assault rifle. He was an adherent of the racist conspiracy theory known as replacement theory, which posits that white Americans are being displaced by immigrants and people of color. Nearly half of the Republicans told pollsters recently that they agree with the general thesis that a cabal of powerful people is encouraging immigrants to come to the United States to sway politics. The combination of paranoia and firearms has led to tragedy again and again. Why are we willing to live with this carnage? President Biden asked the nation on Tuesday, 24th of May. The report of each gunshot in a mass killing echoes long after the next killing eclipses it. According to his family, Joe Garcia, Irma Garcia's husband, died on Thursday, 26th of May, of a heart attack. Mr. Garcia, a 50-year-old, had just gotten home from the memorial for his wife on Thursday morning when he collapsed. It is entirely reasonable to ask how much more of this a nation can be expected to bear. The answer is infuriating. There have been 213 mass shootings in the United States in the first 21 weeks of 2022. An average of 321 Americans are shot every single day. And every day, there are roughly more than 50,000 gun sales recorded in the U.S. Properly maintained, those guns will fire like new for decades. There was some hope after a massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, which left 20 children and 6 teachers dead, that America had finally reached the limit of tragedy it could withstand, and that perhaps the gun lobby had reached the high water mark of its power. A decade later, neither of those holds true. On Friday, the former president, Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina all spoke at the annual convention of the National Rifles Association, NRA, in Houston, Texas, just a few hours' drive from Uvalde. There is no better manifestation of the gun lobby's total capture of so much of the Republican Party. States around the country have made halting but commendable progress in passing sensible gun safety measures, red flag laws, background checks, and age of purchase requirements. They face stiff headwinds. A federal court this month struck down a California law that set the age limit for purchasing semi-automatic weapons at 21. But the legislature is now considering other promising bills that would limit the advertising of certain guns to children and allow Californians to sue gun makers. Anything that introduces friction into the system of gun acquisition is to the good. In New York this week, a federal judge tossed out a challenge from gun groups to a law that allows civil lawsuits against companies that have endangered public safety. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on the legislature to raise the age limit to purchase some assault weapons to 21. The shooter in Texas waited until his 18th birthday to buy a pair of assault weapons and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. In Washington, D.C., there is talk that Republican and Democratic lawmakers might make a deal on some type of national red flag law, which would allow the police to take guns away from people judged to be an imminent danger either to themselves or to others. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, has been leading a bipartisan group of senators that is considering establishing a more comprehensive federal background check system, a reform supported by 88% of the American public. We have seen these bipartisan efforts on gun safety measures come and go without results. Still, in the face of Republican intransigence, Democrats, and President Biden in particular, should do whatever they can. Senator Chris Murphy, who has led the charge for tougher gun regulations since Sandy Hook, put it well on the floor of the Senate this past week. "What are we doing?" he asked his colleagues. "Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority?" he wondered. if the answer is to do nothing, as the slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives. It's a question that speaks to the Senate directly and the entire system of American government more broadly. Yes, the country's democratic system represents a diversity of views in the country on guns. But as currently structured, Congress is fundamentally unresponsive to the needs of its most vulnerable citizens and has been corrupted by powerful interest groups, allowing those groups to block even modest changes to laws that the vast majority of Americans support. We, the American public, all share this vast country and need to figure out how to make it better and keep one another alive and thriving. Right now, we're falling at that primary responsibility. There are glimmers of hope, especially at the state level, that things are changing. But even there, progress is agonizingly slow and won't be enough for the hundreds of Americans who will be shot today and tomorrow and every day until action is taken.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel has gone ahead with a so-called Flag Day, yet the celebration is based on the false premise that Israel has a land of its own, which legally it does not. It's occupying Palestine. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the significance of Israel Flag March Day, why it is so controversial, especially when it comes to Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and why Palestinians are rising up against the Israeli regime, by some accounts, more than ever before. First, let's find out the latest as to what transpired there on the ground. Mona Kandil is a correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, we understand that before and during this so-called Flag Day, there were some scuffles, skirmishes, and there were some Palestinians that were arrested. What do you have for us? What happened?
Well, yes, the march, or the what's known as the flag march, was supposed to take place in the afternoon hours. However, Israeli settlers in groups, let's say from 40 to 50 Israeli settlers, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in the early hours of Sunday, escorted and protected by Israeli police, of course, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and clashed with the Palestinian worshippers who had been in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in an attempt to prevent settlers from storming the Muslim holy site. This led to Israeli forces attacking the Palestinians, firing heavy tear gas, arresting a number of people. According to Palestinian paramedics in the city of Al-Quds, some 50 Palestinians were wounded in the early hours of Sunday. Dozens had been arrested by the Israeli forces as well. This had forced the Israeli troops to force out the Palestinian worshippers from the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in order to allow the settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. All the gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex, the gates leading to the old town of Al-Quds, had completely closed by the Israeli forces. Only the residents of the old town of Al-Quds and the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds were allowed to enter these areas. Other Palestinians from Al-Quds itself were not allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the old town of Al-Quds. As the footage were clear, we are speaking about some tens of thousands of Israeli settlers have marched today in Al-Quds and the old town of Al-Quds. Thousands others, however, unfortunately, have marched through the Muslim quarter of the city. Clashes have taken place. A number of Palestinians had been also wounded. The Israeli settlers were waving the Israeli flags in a very provocative move and in a challenging move. But we can say that the settlers have reached the Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate. It's one of the gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they were not allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as they were thinking or as they were planning previously. We have to mention that one of the Israeli extremist lawmakers, Ben-Gavir, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, but in the early hours of Sunday. Also, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also took part in this flag march and raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in the early hours of Sunday as well.
Very well. Thank you very much. It's interesting you taking note of that ultra-nationalist opposition party, as it's called, Itamar Ben-Gavir, because we're going to ask our guests about that. Mona Kandil, thank you. Of course, Mona there from occupied Ramallah. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Charlotte Cates from the Samadu and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is Amal Wahdan, who's a Palestinian human rights advocate, who joins us from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Very well. Welcome to you both. Charlotte Cates, I'm going to start first with you. And let's get some idea from you as to why this so-called annual flag march is so controversial and so provocative, as it has been described, especially for the viewers who don't know exactly what is going on when it comes to the way that Palestinians feel like they're being, at a minimum, provoked by this.
Well, this is a blatantly fascist, racist march through occupied Jerusalem that is meant to declare Zionist sovereignty over the Palestinian capital, Jerusalem, which is also not only the capital of Palestine, but a revered holy site to Christian and Muslim Palestinians and to people around the world. And so this is an attempt to, with the full support and backing of the Zionist state, of the regime itself, with armed forces, armed guards, police and occupation soldiers, to attack Palestinians, arrest them, lock them up on behalf of these fascists. It's really the display of an outright fascist hate march directed against the Palestinian people. And with the express and declared intention of seeking to destroy the holy sites of Palestinians and claim them for the occupation for eternity. And so obviously the Palestinian people, their resistance, their organizations, and their movements are standing against and rejecting what is a blatant fascist hate march through occupied Jerusalem. And that's why Palestinians everywhere are standing up against this kind of fascist display.
Amal Wahdan, one of the things that stood out looking at some of the video footage of some of these what's called extremists, Israeli settlers, which I'd like to find out from you what that term exactly means. But one of the things that was very noticeable, just looking at the footage that was being played, is the fact that there were so many of them that were so young. They looked like they were in their teens. I'm wondering what kind of information they have been fed when it comes to the occupation, when it comes to what is going on with Al-Quds, for example, or many other facets of why there is a crisis, given the age that is witnessed in some of these people who are marking, or Israelis who are marking this. And tell us why they are called extremist settlers.
Today it was a real battleground in Jerusalem between the owners of the land, the indigenous people of the land of Palestine, and these colonial settlers who were trying to prove the tales, of course, to prove that Jerusalem, United Jerusalem, is their eternal capital. The Palestinians have shown the world today, again, once again, that they are united not only in Jerusalem and the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque, but in all of Palestine and internationally in other capitals of the world where people raise the Palestinian flag as a sign of the unity of Palestinians and the unity of the homeland as well. These settlers try to show that they have the upper hand, and Bennett and his government, his extremist racist government, and the whole apartheid regime in this state, were trying to raise to gain more politically out of this flag march in Jerusalem. At the beginning, it was on the scores of settlers who were marching towards Damascus gate, but later on, more and more settlers, racist settlers, and I have to say these are the most fascist Zionist settlers in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. But they've been seeing lots of confrontations since the early morning in Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Palestinians were defending their sacred holy places. And along the day, we have seen lots of clashes inside Jerusalem and the Old City and in other parts of the West Bank. There is over 100 people were injured by rubber bullets and by tear gas bombs.
Right.
And in Jerusalem, in Azahra Gate, a big demonstration with the Palestinian flag was blocking the road in front of thousands of Israeli soldiers and border guards who were trying to to stop that demonstration from progressing. But they blocked it with big trash bins, and the soldiers couldn't get into the street until later today.
Well, since you mentioned that, Charlotte Case, there needs to be a note made here about how when the Palestinians are protesting, waving their flags, they are forbidden to do so, and the media portrays them, of course, to the eyes and mouths of the officials, that they are terrorists, and they're the ones that are creating or the cause of the violence. And yet when you have these extremist settlers, whom I understand, for example, this one particular leader, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the leader of what's called a small ultranationalist opposition party, who entered the compound early on Sunday along with dozens of supporters, yet they're okay. They're being escorted by security forces, but they are all right, and they're the ones who obviously, as they say, have a claim and have a right on this. Two different narratives there.
Yes, well, when you look at people like Ben-Gvir and you look at these fascist forces, the reality is that these aren't just individuals. These aren't just a few extremists that don't represent the reality of Zionist politics today. In reality, Ben-Gvir and his ilk are the face of the Bennett government. They are the face of the Israeli regime. They are being protected and supported by armed forces, by the border police. When Ben-Gvir and his fascist hordes want to invade Al-Aqsa, the result is that dozens of Palestinians are tear gassed, shot with rubber bullets, or thrown in occupation prisons as a result of their fascist attacks, while those fascists are protected by the armed force of the state. So it's very clear that what we're seeing once again is that as the so-called coalition government is failing inside the Zionist project itself, that there's an attempt to externalize their contradictions and their problems by placing Palestinians by Palestinian land, Palestinian holy sites, and the Palestinian people atop everything else as kind of the target of all of these fascist forces. It really indicates just how openly fascist, openly genocidal, openly propagating terror against civilians the Israeli occupation state is. I mean, this is something that when we look at things like the assassination of journalists like Shireen Abu Akleh, the attack on Palestinians carrying her coffin in a funeral, this is no different in reality, whether it's carried out by a so-called extremist waving the flag of the occupation settler state or an armed member of the occupation forces wearing that flag as a patch on his arm. The reality is this is a reflective of the full-scale fascistization of the occupation regime, and that while we see European countries like Germany that like to proclaim themselves defenders of human rights and opponents to fascism who have learned from the bloody history of Nazi Germany, what we're seeing instead is that they're following in the path of the Zionist regime in terms of arresting people inside their capital, Berlin, for carrying Palestinian flags and commemorating the Nakba. And this is why it is so great that we do see people everywhere around the world, particularly Palestinians in exile and diaspora, but people everywhere raising the Palestinian flag today to make it clear that this so-called march of flags of these fascists is not something that will prevail, not in Al-Aqsa, not in Jerusalem, and not anywhere else in the world.
Something that is understood widely, and I'd like to ask you, Amal Wahdan, about it, is that isn't it true that Jewish worship is actually not permitted at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound based on Israeli law? Isn't that the case? And that it's also forbidden, for example, for the chief rabbinate of Israel to not do that. And at the same time, we're seeing how these fascist or right-wing Israelis, they believe that they should be able to pray at the Al-Aqsa compound or inside the mosque. But that's an effort that's backed by the ruling coalition at this point and previous ones in order to change the status quo. Is that the case, these facts?
Of course, after the U.S. under Trump moved its embassy to Jerusalem, the settler movement, the Zionist settlers movement, have gained momentum. And they thought that if the U.S. now opened the gate for them to announce Jerusalem as their united eternal capital, they have a free hand to do everything, including splitting the place and time, as we say it, of Al-Aqsa Mosque, following the case of the Ebrahimi Mosque in Hebron. But the Palestinians are trying to prevent this by any price and with all the means that they have since the morning. And we witnessed that during the month of Ramadan, this battle has been going on and on. And these Zionists, racist settlers, are covered, actually, by Bennett and his party and by other right-wing and radical Zionists in the government and outside the government. As we mentioned before, there's about 63 Zionist organizations who are eagerly working to continue digging beneath the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And there were threats, actually, a few days ago that they want to demolish Al-Aqsa Mosque. So they are trying over and over again, and they are blessed by their government and by the USA, to prove that this is a religious war. While on the ground, this is not a religious war. Palestinians in Palestine with and their different religions were living side by side, never had any problems before. But when they started, when the Zionist movement started to politicize religion, the slogan of religion was raised again by the Zionist terrorist movement before 1948 and afterwards. Now they are, because they are losing grip and they are losing the battle in all of Palestine, which is united now as a homeland and as a people, after they lose their grip, they wanted to turn the whole thing upside down and portray it as a religious war. And we are aware of this, and we won't let it go this far. We will prevent these settlers from changing the status quo in Jerusalem and in Al-Aqsa Mosque. And hopefully, with this unity that we've seen today and in the past months, we're going to succeed to prevent these racists, these Zionist racists, and this apartheid regime to continue doing what they have learned from the fascists and from the Nazis decades ago.
Well, Charlotte Cates, our guest there, talks about how Palestinians' resistance has actually increased, to say the least. Of course, we could talk about the way that the Palestinian cause is highlighted ever more when it comes to social media, for example, and just the awareness. And taking a look at and doing a fact check here, as Palestinians, for example, commemorated the 74th anniversary of their forced displacement, the Nakba, we're looking at how not only is there a new spirit, and based on these facts, Palestinian attacks against Israelis to have increased at this point, resulting in the killing of 18. I'm not promoting death here, nor killing. I'm just looking at what is going on when it comes to Palestinians and how they're resisting. This number that I cited represents an unprecedented number since the Second Intifada, which ended in 2005. Okay, so this is just one particular source. Do you see Palestinians rising up more than before when it comes to what has transpired, for example, in the past year?
Well, we are 1 year out from the anniversary of the Battle of Saif al-Quds, or the Unity Intifada, which was really a tremendous collective representation of the participation of the armed resistance and the participation of Palestinians at a popular level throughout occupied Palestine, from the river to the sea and everywhere in exile and diaspora, and even the sort of global camp of resistance and progressive forces everywhere in the world. And so this is why from Alid to Haifa to Ramallah to Gaza to Berlin and New York and Amsterdam, we see Palestinians marching and taking the streets to make it clear that Palestine is non-negotiable. And I think it's perhaps more clear than it has been in decades, is particularly since the beginning of the so-called Oslo Peace Project, that the demand of the Palestinian people and their resistance is the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and that it's not acceptable to have a compromise with fascism, racism, and this Zionist project that is bent on the destruction of the Palestinian people. Instead, the resistance is growing, defending itself and defending the Palestinian people and their right to life and their right to exist and their right to survive and thrive throughout occupied Palestine. And that's why it is so important that people around the world, especially when Western governments are continuing to not only excuse the fascist behavior and practices of the occupation regime, but actually fund it and support it with arms and weapons and votes in the United Nations, that it's so important that we do everything we can to escalate the movement, to boycott and isolate the Zionist project, and that we do everything that we can to take to the streets and stop this ongoing imperialist Zionist project attacking the Palestinian people, and in to do this in support of the Palestinians and their resistance, which is growing stronger every day. And that's very obvious. The reality is that Bennett, his coalition, Ben-Gvir, these fascist forces are not engaging in these kinds of provocations and hate marches out of a sense of strength. They're engaging in these practices out of a sense of, you know, really fundamental fear and coming to grips with the reality that an artificially imposed settler colonial project inside occupied Palestine will never have a path to victory and security. The only path to security is the liberation of Palestine.
Final question, Amal Wahdan. One thing that is missing and has been missing for quite some time is the support that Palestinians need to have gotten from their respective Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, for example, Saudi Arabia. But we're looking at a certain countries like the UAE or like Bahrain, who have formalized their ties in the so-called normalization with Israel. How much has that, which has been accurately been viewed as a stab in the back of Palestinians? In 30 seconds, please.
Yes, well, it is a stab in the back, right? But at the end, the Palestinians took their cause in their own hands, and they know their strength, and they've have experienced this strength. The flag battle today that was manifested in Jerusalem was actually because our people in 1948 took into the street last year, and it didn't the normalization of the Gulf states with Israel never stop the Palestinians from carrying their flag. Okay. Today, the flag was flying with a drone over Jerusalem. And is a defeat for the Zionist project in all of Palestine.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. Amal Wahdan there, Palestinian human rights advocate. And thank